within the Pendergast family plot. It is all spelled out in the application.
"Examination," Jennings said. "Is this related to some sort of question of inheritance?"
"No, it's strictly a private matter."
"But this is irregular, Mr. Pendergast, most irregular. I can't say I've ever had such a request before. I'm sorry, but this is not something I can approve. You'll have to go through the courts."
Pendergast regarded him for a moment. "Is that your final word on the subject?"
"The guidelines on exhumations are quite clear. I can do nothing."
Jennings spread his hands. "I see." Pendergast picked up the shield and replaced it in his suit jacket. He left the paperwork where it was. "Would you mind coming with me for a moment?"
"But where?"
"It will only take a minute." Reluctantly, Jennings rose out of his seat. "I wish to show you," Pendergast said, "why I chose you in particular for this request." They walked through the outer office, down the main corridor of the public building, and out of the main entrance. Pendergast stopped on the wide front steps. Jennings looked around at the bustling thoroughfare.
"Like I said, pleasant day," he observed
with excessive cheer, trying to make small talk. "Pleasant day indeed," came the reply.
"That's what I love about this part of Louisiana. The sun just seems to shine more brightly than anywhere else."
"Yes, it lends a curious gilding effect to everything it touches. Take that plaque, for instance," and Pendergast gestured toward an old brass plaque that had been set into the brick facade of the building. Jennings peered at the plaque. He passed it every morning, of course, on the way to his office, but it had been many years since he had bothered to examine it. This city hall of Plankwood, Louisiana, was erected with funds generously donated by Comstock Erasmus Pendergast in the year of our Lord, 1892.
"Comstock Pendergast,"
Jennings murmured under his breath. No wonder the name seemed vaguely familiar. "My great-granduncle. The Pendergast family, you see, has long had a tradition of supporting certain towns in the parishes of both New Orleans and St. Charles, places where various branches of our family lived these past centuries. While we may no longer be around in many of these towns, our legacy lives on."
"Of course," Jennings said, still staring at the plaque.
He began to conceive a rather unpleasant notion as to why Pendergast had been so particular in selecting his office for the request. "We don't advertise it, but the fact is the various Pendergast trusts and charities continue to make benefactions to several towns, including Plankwood." Jennings looked from the plaque to Pendergast.
"Plankwood?"
Pendergast nodded. "Our trusts provide scholarships to graduating seniors, help maintain the police auxiliary fund, buy books for the library, and support the good work of your very own public health office. It would be a shame to see this support falter, or perhaps cease entirely."
"Cease?"
Jennings repeated. "Programs might be cut." Pendergast's gaunt features assumed a sorrowful cast. "Salaries reduced. Jobs lost." He placed a certain emphasis on this last phrase as his gray eyes affixed Jennings. Jennings raised a hand to his chin, rubbed it thoughtfully.
"Now, on second thought, Mr. Pendergast, I feel certain your request might be reviewed favorably, if you can assure me that it is of great importance."
"I can, Mr. Jennings."
"In that case, I'll get the application process started."
He glanced back at the plaque.
"I could even go so far as to promise you that the paperwork will be put through in a rush. In 10 days, perhaps as little as a week, we can have this order approved."
"I'll stop by for it tomorrow afternoon, thank you," Pendergast said.
"What?"
Jennings removed his glasses, blinked in the sunlight.
"Oh, of course. Tomorrow afternoon."
Chapter 30. Boston, Massachusetts. The man, with the sunken eyes and 5 o'clock shadow, shuffled across Copley Square, in the shadow of the John Hancock Tower. Except for brief glances at the passing traffic, his head hung dejectedly, his hands were deep in the pockets of his grimy raincoat. He walked down Dartmouth Street and entered the Copley subway station. Passing the line of people buying Charlie cards, he slouched down the cement staircase and stopped, looking around. A row of benches was set against the tiled wall to his right, and he made his way toward them, sitting down at the far end. There he lounged, unmoving, hands still buried in the pockets of his raincoat, staring at nothing. A few minutes later, another man strolled up. He could not have looked more different. He was thin and tall, dressed in a well-tailored suit and a Burberry trench coat. In one hand he held a copy of the Boston Globe, neatly folded. In the other was a crisply rolled black umbrella. A large gray fedora kept his face in shadow. The only distinguishing mark was an odd-looking mole underneath his right eye. Sitting down beside the derelict, he opened the paper wide and began perusing the inside stories. When a Green Line train squealed its way into the station, the man in the fedora began to speak. He spoke quietly, under the noise of the train, and he kept his gaze on the newspaper.
"State the nature of the problem," he said in accented English.
The derelict let his head hang as he replied.
"It's this fellow Pendergast, my brother-in-law. He's found out the truth."
"The truth? All of it?"
"Not yet, but he will. He's an extremely competent and dangerous man."
"What does he know exactly?"
"He knows that what happened in Africa, the lion killing, was murder. He knows all about Project Aves, and he knows," Esterhazy hesitated, "he knows about Slade and Longitude Pharmaceuticals, the Doan family, and Spanish Island."
"Ah, yes, Spanish Island," said the man. "This is something we have just learned. We now are aware Charles Slade's death 12 years ago was an elaborate hoax, and that he was still alive until some 7 months ago. This is most unfortunate news. Why didn't you tell us these things?"
"I had no idea either," Esterhazy lied as forcefully as he could. "I swear to you, I didn't know anything about it."
He just had to put the genie back in the bottle, once and for all, or he was as good as dead. He found his voice moving up a notch.